This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell. Today we are speaking with George Werthner. Longtime listeners of this program are likely familiar with George Werthner. He is an ecologist and writer who has published 38 books on various topics relating to environmental and natural history. He has visited over 400 designated wilderness areas and over 200 national park units. In the past, he has worked in multiple of our nation's wildlands. He has worked as a freelance writer and photographer, a high school science teacher, and more recently, ecological projects director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. He currently is the executive director of Public Lands Media. He's been on the board or acted as science advisor for numerous environmental organizations. To name just a few in a long list, he is on the science advisory board of the Gallatin Wildlife Association and the board president of Restore the North Woods. One focus of George's advocacy has been the expansion of national parklands throughout the United States. This will be the focus of our conversation today. George, thank you for joining the program.
You bet.
So one of the areas you've been focused on in expanding national parklands is right here in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. Could you tell us a bit about the proposal for a Greater Yellowstone National Park?
Sure. First, as context, the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem is, some say, the last major temperate range ecosystem that's still basically functional. So that makes it globally unique. And it's been recognized for its global uniqueness as a UN Biosphere Reserve and a World Heritage Site. So, I mean, it's got recognition around the world as a significant area. One of the unique things about the ecosystem, it still has all the wildlife, with one exception I could tell you, is a grasshopper, unfortunately, that went extinct. Mm-hmm. But basically all the larger animals that were found there when Lewis and Clark went through the area in the early 1800s. And so that alone makes it pretty significant. There aren't a lot of places in the lower 48 states that can make a claim like that. And part of it, the reason for that is that Yellowstone Park itself is a fairly large area for parks. It's 2.2 million acres. But one of the things, if that were all we had, clearly, Yellowstone in and of itself is not large enough to maintain ecological functions like migratory wildlife, a significant number of predator-prey species. If you just had Yellowstone Park, it'd be questionable whether there'd be enough grizzly bears to survive in the long run, etc. So Yellowstone Park depends on the surrounding other public lands, many of which are designated wilderness areas, like the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness to the north, the Teton Wilderness to the south, the Washakie Wilderness to the east, etc. And those lands, for those that are not familiar, wilderness is managed to minimize human intrusions. So you can't have, for example, machinery in a wilderness area. You can't log in a wilderness area. You can't utilize poisons in the streams. I mean, there's a lot of things that are usually not permitted in wilderness areas. So the wilderness areas are part of the surrounding area that sort of this core of the park helped to maintain its ecological integrity. However, there are still things that are allowed in wilderness areas that would never happen in Yellowstone Park. For example, as soon as a wolf leaves Yellowstone Park, it may get killed, even in wilderness areas, because trapping and hunting are permitted in wilderness areas, whereas hunting and trapping are not prohibited within national parks as a rule. And the other thing that goes on, too, is that in Yellowstone, for better or for worse, some people don't like this, but for better or for worse, any of the backcountry use is very restricted. About a quarter of the park is off limits to anybody going in there unless you have a special permit. And there are various reasons. It might be because there's wolf dens nearby, or it's an important area for grizzly bears and so forth. But my point is that the Park Service puts the wildlife as a priority in many cases, whereas even in wilderness areas, as far as I know, there are very few places with any kind of restrictions like that. Okay, we're going to protect, you know, grizzly bear habitat by prohibiting people going into that area. So the management and that the Park Service does from a wildlife perspective, in my view, is superior to the management you find on national forests. You take the whole ecosystem, and I did a study of biological hotspots of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And what we did is we tried to map the important habitat focused on where there were concentrations of either rare plants and wildlife or important winter range for elk, you know, criteria like that. And then we used that evaluation to determine which parts of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem were most important for maintaining wildlife and plant diversity into the future. And so anyway, we identified those places. And then as a further part of our analysis, we also looked at how threatened are they and by what. So some of these places for whatever reason are so remote that as far as we could tell, there was no immediate threats to their integrity. And others might be like the Gallatin Valley. That wasn't a biological hotspot, but I'm using it as a hypothetical. Because of all the growth in the Gallatin Valley, if that were one of our hotspots, we would have said the threat would have come from, you know, on-zone subdivisions or something. In other areas, the threat, like down around Pinedale, Wyoming, in the upper Green River area, that area has had a lot of oil and gas development, for example. So that would be the major threat in that area. When you start looking around, and this is 25 years ago, but almost all the threats that we identified have just intensified. In other words, there's more subdivisions, there's more oil and gas, there's more effects of climate change, etc. And so when you consider that, you have to say, well, how are we going to maintain the ecological integrity of this area, though, in the long run? And my solution is to expand what is the boundaries of Yellowstone National Park to take in basically the greater Yellowstone ecosystem and put it all under the National Park management. And there's several reasons for that. One, right now, if you go to any particular piece of land outside of Yellowstone, it might be managed by the BLM, it might be managed by the Fish and Wildlife Service, it might be managed by the Forest Service, it might be managed by the state of Montana or Wyoming State or Idaho, and or even private entities, preserves, you know, maybe a nature conservancy preserve or whatever. The point being is there's no consistency in all these things. What might be prohibited, like the example I said about killing wolves, it's prohibited in the national park, but as soon as you cross the boundary into the Gallatin National Forest, it's open to killing wolves. So there's no overriding management plan that is designed to maintain that ecological integrity. And the other, there are a couple other things, just from a biological conservation biology perspective, there's a rule or a tenet, you might say, that says the larger the protected area, the better the chances it will sustain its ecological function into the future. And as I said, the there's this sort of cut by a thousand knife blades, or however you want to express it, gradually making the ecosystem less functional. And of course, a lot of that has to do with what happens on private land. And what I'm proposing as a Greater Yellowstone National Park wouldn't address the private lands per se, but that could even be written into any kind of legislation. You could have legislation that says when there's large parcels of private land available for sale, the federal government would seek to try to acquire it, for example. Then you would have the best chances of preserving that ecological integrity into the future. And well, the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, depending upon where you draw the boundaries, is anywhere from about 23 million to 26, 27 million acres. And to put that into some context, the state of Maine is 20 million acres. So the ecosystem, as typically defined, is even bigger in the state of Maine. But China just designated a national park that's 47 million acres. I don't really like to promote this sort of like, oh, we have to be the best kind of American exceptionalism. But if you were inclined to want to promote that, we could say, how can we let China have this huge national park and we have this little piddly park that's only 2.2 million acres? Right. And so we really need to catch up here. Doing a preservation of the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem would put us on track for that. And the other thing that you see, for example, another problem that I identified in my biological overview is livestock production is a major impact across the whole ecosystem. And in a whole lot of ways that I'm not going to articulate in detail, but, you know, cattle are the main reason for damage to riparian areas. They are one of the reasons why wolves and grizzlies get killed. For example, in the Upper Green, there's been dozens of grizzly bears killed to protect cattle grazing on national forest lands. They pollute the water, they spread weeds. There's just competition for forage between native herbivores and domestic cattle. So, of course, if I were the king and could make this Greater Yellowstone ecosystem a national park, I would eliminate livestock grazing over that whole area. And that would be a significant improvement to the ecological integrity of the area. And the other thing that, as I started to mention, I mentioned these areas that are off limits, like bear management areas and so forth, where people are not allowed to go. But even where people are allowed to go in Yellowstone, it's managed significantly different than some of the surrounding wilderness areas, which some people don't like because it's more restrictive. In other words, for example, if you go in the backcountry in Yellowstone, you have to have an overnight permit and you have to stay in designated campsites. And part of the reason for that is all the designated campsites have places to hang your food from bears, or they have bear canisters and ways to protect the bears from getting food addicted to humans. And also predictable corridors where most people are going to be found hiking. And that can help wildlife. And as a result of that system, there's actually less backcountry use in Yellowstone than there is in some of the surrounding wilderness areas. And so when people say Yellowstone's being loved to death, in my view, it's kind of a misnomer. From the areas that are developed in Yellowstone, it's about 6,000 acres, you know, Old Faithful and the Grand Canyon of Yellowstone and Mammoth and so forth. But 6,000 acres out of 2.2 million is not that significant. And most of it's concentrated on the roads. And sure, you can't find a place to park at Old Faithful in the middle of the afternoon on a summer day, maybe. But that's a social impact. That's not so much an ecological impact. So from an ecological perspective, I think that the Park Service does a better job of maintaining ecological integrity. And they're not perfect. They're subject to politics like any agency. And right now, the Trump administration has cut the staffing, and a lot of the studies that were ongoing have been halted. But still, overall, I think that the Park Service does a better job. And so the other thing, and I'm not saying that this is the reason why you should do this, and some people will say this is the reason you shouldn't do it, but perhaps. but national parks, you know, they attract people, and most communities that are near national parks do better economically than communities that are far from national parks. There's lots of studies that show that. And it's not just because tourists spend money there. It's also because people want to live near parks. Footloose people that don't have a job that isn't required going to work in a specific place every day. And, you know, for years, for example, I was a freelance writer and photographer living in Livingston, and I didn't work in Livingston. I mean, my clients were in New York or California or wherever I could sell stuff, but I spent the money locally and I paid the taxes locally, and I helped sustain Livingston schools and roads and so forth. But I brought in money from far away. And why did I live in Livingston? Because I like being next to Yellowstone Park. And so that kind of thing, that economic factor happens. So that's the other reason for it. And the basic thing that I'm trying to get at is that This is a globally significant ecosystem. This is not just your run-of-the-mill, and we're not treating it like it's globally significant. I mean, we're doing things like killing the wolves from Yellowstone just outside the park. We're shooting bison as soon as they leave the park. We're allowing, in some cases, exotic fish to be stocked in some of the lakes and streams and outside the park. The park's trying to promote native fish, but the management decisions that are being made outside of Yellowstone Park are somewhat counterproductive for the long-term ecological integrity of the ecosystem. And so I'm just saying that if we really want to be serious about preserving the ecological functions and processes into the future, and that 100 years from now, people can still go to this area and there will be wolves, there will be grizzly bears, there will be migratory elk herds. There will be native fish in the streams, and there will be, you know, things will be happening. There'll be maybe less forest because drying out of forests and maybe more wildfires and so forth. But that's all part of the processes, the evolutionary processes that keep all these things functioning. And for that to happen, you need large areas because, you know, if a 100,000 acres burns and, you know, Yellowstone Park is not a big deal, but if 100,000 acres were to burn, you know, adjacent to some little park in some state like New York or New Jersey or something like that, it might consume the whole park. So people can't allow those processes to continue. So that's the other idea. Big is better, and it's people are attracted to bold visions. So I'm hoping people are attracted to this vision. And to be frank, I don't necessarily see this happening overnight. What I've seen with conservation history is somebody has to articulate an idea. And if it's a good idea, it will over time become popular and become considered not so outrageous, you might say. Like it gains popularity, it gains realistic realism to people. So that's what I'm trying to say. And the other thing I might add is that you can add an overlay of wilderness to all these lands too. But ironically, Yellowstone doesn't have designated wilderness, and neither does Grand Teton National Park. And you know, adding a layer of wilderness on top of the Park Service lands would do even more to maintain that ecological integrity over the long run. So
I do want to circle back to some history of this issue. So the goal of expanding kind of protections and wilderness designations within the broader ecosystem of the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem was included in an act called the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act. And that was about in the 90s. Could you tell us about this act, what the current status of it is now, and what success it has towards working towards its ultimate goal of expanding the borders of Greater Yellowstone National Park?
Yeah, its short name or acronym name is NREPA. And NREPA has, as you stated, been around for a long time. Every session of Congress, it's been introduced. And right. It has gained quite a bit of support, both in the Senate and in the House over the years, but not enough to push it over and make it a law. But basically, NREPA would protect over 20 million acres of land, not just in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, but across five states: Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming. Basically, everything that is roadless and not protected, in other words, that would qualify under the Wilderness Act as wilderness, is included in the NREPA language. And it also has some other things in there, like wilderness, wildlands restoration for some areas that have been logged. It has a proposal for a national park, actually, in Hell's Canyon area. So it's multifaceted, and it is, to me, a very visionary and bold proposal that I hope someday will be enacted. And you know what I've seen in conservation? It's serendipitous when any good legislation gets passed. but you've got to have it out there all the time. So when the stars line up, then the legislation gets approved. People can propose things for years and nothing happens. And then finally, it goes and it gets the protection. I'll give you a funny story about one. That's the Olympic National Park. That's in Washington. It was first set aside as a national monument under the National Forest Management. And the Forest Service was logging some of this area. And people in Washington and all the way to East Coast felt it should be protected because it had giant forests, you know, some of the best, biggest trees in the West Coast. And so there was a variety of proposals to try to protect it as a national park. And by the 1930s, okay, it was designated a national monument in like 1908 or 1906, something like that. By the 1930s, this park proposal was gaining momentum. And the Forest Service, which had the administration for it, didn't want to lose the Olympic Mountains and the timber to the National Park Service. So Franklin Roosevelt was president at that time. And it was a controversy, and he decided to come out and see it firsthand. And the forest supervisor had a bunch of seasonal workers go out and change the sign that said, "Welcome to Olympic National Forest," and move it to the edge of a clear cut so that the clear cut did not appear to be part of the national forest and the monument. And so the supervisor is giving a ride to the president, showing him the land, and they drive through this sea of stumps. And Franklin Roosevelt says to the forest supervisor, "Who's the son of a bitch who put allowed this to happen?" And the forest supervisor is, you know, sitting right next to him and saying, "Oh, gosh." And then they get to the sign that says, "Welcome to Olympic National Forest." And Roosevelt turns to the supervisor and says, "God, this is beautiful. You guys are doing a great job." Well, he gives a speech in Seattle, and a couple of the workers that had moved the sign read about the speech saying that the clear cut, and they realized what they had done to facilitate this myth. And so they wrote the president and said, "Well, this area was actually, you rode through as part of the national monument that the Forest Service was logging." And so when Roosevelt heard that, he said, "Okay, it's a national park." So that's an example. Who could have predicted those circumstances? Totally serendipitous. But if there hadn't been a proposal for a park there to begin with, it would have never happened. And sure. So that's what I say about a lot of this stuff. You can't predict it, but you got to be ready. And being ready means you have to have the stuff out there. So like NAREPA's legislative proposals out there. And one of these times the stars are going to line up and it's probably going to pass in some form.
Sure. What have been the greatest pushbacks against this effort and how are they being navigated?
Well, you know, anytime you're talking about large land protection, you get opposition from usually industry of some sort, logging, mining, oil and gas, livestock industry, et cetera. And even today, some recreationists are opposed. So, for example, there's a significant number of mountain bikers who don't want to see wilderness because you can't have wheeled vehicles in wilderness. So they're opposing it too in some cases. So that's what usually happens is there's pretty predictable opposition. But in a lot of cases, particularly anymore these days, the best of any of these things were already exploited. In other words, the best timber was cut. The best oil and gas places have already been drilled. And they're not going to be available for being protected anyway by any legislation. The best places for, you know, the major mining areas are outside of wilderness and left so outside of wilderness for that reason. So in some ways, it's interesting. I think it's easier today to propose these protections than it was in the past, although there's a lot of people I know in some of the conservation communities, that's impossible. But I give the example of Sorka Beartooth Wilderness, which is almost 1 million acres that was protected in 1978. But when it was proposed, you had every chamber of commerce from Bozeman to Billings against it. You had 8 sawmills who were utilizing some timber in the area or near the areas that would be wilderness that were opposed. You had, you know, ranching community that was opposed to it. You had the opposition from the ORV community, snowmobilers and dirt bikers and so forth. So, I mean, you had all this opposition, and yet it was able to be passed. And part of it is, I think the people that promote these things and work for these things love the land and they have a passion. Today, we have a lot of these industries, timber industry, livestock industry, mining industry, and so forth. They're either in the places that have the best opportunities for their exploitation, and it's already outside of any proposal, for the very reason that in exploiting it, they make it so it wouldn't qualify for a park or for wilderness. You know, if you logged it already, you got logging roads all over. Well, it's hard to include that in a wilderness area. So that's one thing. And then the other is a lot of these resources are found to be better in other places. I'll use logging as an example. The timber industry has been moving over time towards the southeast of the United States, Georgia, Mississippi, and so forth. And there's a good reason, you know, to grow a 10-inch tree in some of the higher elevation parts of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, like, say, around Cook City, where the Forest Service wants to do some logging as a proposal for that. You know, that's at 8,000 feet. It takes almost 100 years to grow a 10-inch tree there, whereas you can go to Georgia and grow a 10-inch tree in 10 years. So you're the timber industry, and where are you going to invest your sawmills and all that? You're going to be in a place where you can grow trees fast, and you don't have to deal with steep mountains to build roads on. You don't have snow half the year keeping you from logging and so forth. So the timber industry has gradually moved to the southeast and abandoned states like Montana for the most part. There's hardly any timber mills left in the state, and they're part of the reason it's not a very good place for timber production, frankly, compared to other parts of the country. And the same is true for a whole lot of other things, you know, like, they do have oil and gas near Pinedale, but still it's easier and better to drill for oil in Texas. You know, the climate's easier, better year-round access there and so forth than it is in Wyoming. So there's a lot of sort of natural factors that make it, unless it's really the best of something, makes it hard to exploit, even if the resource is there.
The main question I have to wrap up this segment is, how can people engage with this effort, follow it and support it, and help you pursue it?
Okay, let me answer that. People can help out the Alliance for the Wild Rockies promote NAREPA, and you can go to their website and find out more about their proposal. And then there's also two other organizations, the Gallatin Wildlife Association, which is interested in protecting the ecosystem, and the Gallatin Yellowstone Wilderness Association, which I'm also president of, has a website where we talk about protecting all these lands in the northern part of the ecosystem, i.e. in Montana. So I think that any one of those, you know, join those organizations, get on the mailing lists and so forth to stay informed. And it's one of those things, you know, talk to your friends about it, talk to your senators, write a letter. You know, sometimes just one or two letters will get a congressman or a senator's attention. I've had congressmen and senators both tell me that. And so don't feel like there's nothing you can do. Everything helps. And promote it among your friends, promote it among politicians, and maybe one day it'll happen.
This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. More information about the association and its activities can be found on its website, www.gallatinwildlife.org. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell.